Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Hi, everyone. My name's Jane, and I'm an alcoholic. And I am so happy to be here at Sessions by the Sea. And I actually had the opportunity to go to the International in Atlanta not too long ago. And I think that this is only the second time that I've been in a room that's this filled with sobriety. Wow. And, of course, I want to thank everyone for just all the beautiful smiles and the wonderful hospitality that's been shown to me since I arrived. I want to thank Popeye for inviting me and all the other wonderful speakers that I've had the opportunity to meet over the last few days. And I want to give Kenny a shout-out over there, the tape guy. Woo! And really encourage you to, you know, buy some tapes, because let me tell you, it's a vocation to do that. And what better gift to give somebody than the gift of a story, of somebody's personal success story in the wonderful rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know, personally speaking, early in my sobriety, I couldn't make it to meetings every day, so I made sure that I had a stash of tapes, and people knew that, so they gave me tapes. And early on, it's really what gave me a lot of strength and hope and kept me sober. So thanks, Kenny, for what you do. And thank you, too, especially to sweet, wonderful James, who actually was the one who got the beach ball rolling here early on Tuesday night, right? So I'm so blessed that that he's my support and my partner, and I see him down there right now, and I'm going to zone in on him because I am shaken, let me tell you. But anyway, as I mentioned before, peace begins with a smile, and I really feel somewhat at peace right now because I feel like I know almost everyone in here. And when I was standing on my beautiful balcony of the room before, and I was just looking over at the beautiful ocean and, you know, staring in magnificence at the wonder of the sea. And I kind of feel like that right now. Like, I mean, I am looking over this sea of people that are all miracles. I mean, it's overwhelming looking out at you right now, because each and every one of us is a miracle. And really, when you boil it all down, most of us should probably be dead, right? I mean, I know I should be. And I'm talking about the Al-Anons, too, with what we alcoholics put you guys through. I mean, you know, the manifestations of the, you know, of what we put you through can kill you. I mean, I know it. I happen to believe that that most disease is caused by stress. So anyway, it's really amazing to think about, too, the fact that everyone took time out of their weeks to take a week off to come to Sessions by the Sea. And it just shows that, you know, we're not a glum lot. We're happy, joyous, and free, and we want to be out there celebrating the fellowship and celebrating our recovery. And I always like the image of butterflies. Like, what good are the wings of a beautiful butterfly if they just remain grounded in self-contempt? So why don't we all just give ourselves another hand for making it here tonight, for flapping our beautiful wings, and showing each other the love. And I also really like to invite Grace in, you know, amazing Grace. And I happen to think that I wouldn't be standing up here if it wasn't for Grace, that's for sure. I love that line that the will of God will never take us where the grace of God won't protect us. And I feel really protected right now. Grace is so beautiful. To me, it's like this lovely undercurrent that runs through life. And all we really have to do is tap into it. You know, it's not there because of anything we've done that we deserve or we don't deserve. It's just always there. And it offers us all those beautiful things in life, like forgiveness and love and illumination, and I feel grace in right now, and I want to just take a moment to invite Grace into the room. And also, I thought it would be nice if you wouldn't mind just closing your eyes and lowering your head, and if we could all just say the third step prayer together. God, I offer myself to Thee, to build with me and to do with me as Thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, so that I may better do Thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of Thy love, Thy power, Thy love, and Thy way of life. May I do Thy will always. You know, the miracle, one of the many miracles of this program is that one alcoholic tells another alcoholic their story somewhere in the world every day. And one of the beautiful things is the counterintuitive wisdoms that this program offers. You know, the ones like, you have to die in order to live, you have to surrender in order to win, you have to suffer in order to get well, and you have to give it away in order to keep it. And that's, my name is Jane, and I'm an alcoholic standing before you tonight, commissioned by Alcoholics Anonymous to share with you what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And I figured a good place to start would be November 20th, 1962, the day I was born. And I was born in a town called Caldwell, New Jersey. Not too far from here. I bet there's some Jersey people here. And I was born into a great family. I mean, that's one of the things that just amazes me, too, about the program. You know, we've got every demographic and every part of the scale, you know, from people who experienced, you know, some very difficult childhoods like James, you know, where, and then people who just have, you know, nondescript childhoods, and then people who were born with a silver spoon in their mouths, right? That was me. I grew up in the most wonderful, loving, nurturing family. I'm one out of five kids. I'm the second oldest. I'm the oldest girl. And the blood that courses through my veins is 100% Irish, both sets of grandparents. So Irish Catholic, I mean, 100%. From the time I can remember, I probably was able to say like the Hail Mary, the Our Father, and the Act of Contrition before I could really put a full sentence together, you know, conversationally. I mean, we just grew up loving our family, loving God, and, you know, enjoying laughter. And really, my childhood was just awesome. I went to Catholic elementary schools, and I should say, too, I'm one of those Catholics that that has really fond memories of being raised that way. And some of the role models from early on were just wonderful nuns and wonderful priests, and I had I can't imagine growing up any differently than under their guidance and their tutelage, and even in recovery, nuns and priests have played a very powerful role. So I'm one of those Catholics that part of my life is parallel to my life in recovery. And I went to a Catholic elementary school. I just to explain my personality back then, I was always, you know, gregarious and talkative and, you know, mischievous and getting into trouble, but, you know, it was like the innocent, wonderful kind of fun. I always thought that God was watching everything that I did, so I really tried to be a good girl. Moving along, I went to an all-girl Catholic high school, and it was a very small school in Caldwell, and I graduated in 1981, and there were only 81 girls in my class. One of my classmates was pretty famous, Whitney Houston, and I like to mention her to, you know, just recall her and just to think about what a tragic ending she had to her life as a result of this disease. And and she's somebody just like myself. There was no indication that we were going to take the wrong turns that we did later on in our lives. So But anyway, high school is when I started to sort of start to rebel. But I was like the all-American kid, you know. I was on the track team. By the way, I should mention this too. I'm really proud of my dad. To let you know just a little bit about how I was raised, my dad was favored to be the first to break the four-minute mile. He was one of Villanova University's first milers, and he actually missed it. The time that he did was 4.00.08. Otherwise, he would have been the first in the world ever to break the four-minute mile. So it says something about his dedication and his discipline, and we were kind of raised like that too. You know, everything was very orderly. We had this healthy fear of my dad, but you know, this awesome, profound respect too. Mom was a stay-at-home mom. You know, really nurtured us and loved us. And in high school is when I started to rebel against her, especially. And the first time that I drank, I was 14 years old. And believe it or not, it was at the original movies in the movie theater of Star Wars. And I mean, I remember I was with my 18-year-old cousin, and she bought in a bottle of rum, and she just kept dumping it into, you know, our Cokes. And I remember just watching that. Now, if you were alive back then, that was like, whoa, state of the art. But I can't help but to think how symbolic it was and how fitting it was, because man, that first time that I drank, it took me out of this world, put me into a whole different galaxy. It was like, woo! I mean, I was like flying around with Han Solo, you know, intergalactically. I mean, really, it was like, wow! And I loved it. But we've heard so many stories about our first juice this week. I remember I got so sick, I did not want to use again. I mean, ever again. I was like, that is it. I am never drinking again, even though it was so much fun. But I got really, really sick because I drank a lot of rum. But anyway, and I didn't. And I remember, you know, just a couple other times drinking in high school. But college is when I broke bad. I went to Manhattan College, which is in New York City, and it was almost like the good little sheltered Catholic schoolgirl living in a glass house, let loose in the big city, and I went buck wild. Where my dormitory was the last stop on the one train, so it was at 242nd Street in Broadway. So I had access to the biggest, baddest city in the world 24/7. And let me tell you something, I ripped that city up. And this was in the, you know, in the 80s. And New York City in the 80s. And I remember, you know, this was the time of like Studio 54, the Peppermint Lounge. You know, I was into like majorly into the club scene and the social scene and the bands and all that kind of stuff. And I remember thinking, like, I couldn't miss anything. So early on in my using, it was like, I think I was more addicted to the social life than I was actually the substances. But I was out all the time. And first semester, I put on 25 pounds. And believe me, it was not the food. I drank, I mean, every single night. And it was funny because most of my friends were like Irish or Italian like I was. And, you know, they went to prep schools like I did. But they were all going crazy. So it was like, oh, well, they're doing it. I might as well do it, too. And I just got swept away in that early on in my college career. I remember I was I graduated second in my class in high school. And so I had big aspirations of going to med school and studying biology and all that. And by sophomore year, I was like an English major, creative writing, and, you know, I mean, I dropped all that stuff to be like this hippie, you know, whatever. So, and speaking of which, that's when I started using outside issues. And, you know, I have to say, the way that I look at outside issues is like, I am all about singleness of purpose. But I also think I would be remiss if I didn't mention, like, okay, I happen to think Addiction is a brain disease. It's a disease of the brain that translates into abnormal behaviors. We all know what those abnormal behaviors are, right? Like, you know, writing bad checks, you know, crime, waking up next to, like, random people, you know, stealing, whatever. And mine was going to the ATM, getting money, and doing drugs. And the one drug was to make the drinking experience, to enhance it and to make it, you know, just so much better. And the other one was to drink harder, faster, longer, talk, dance. Blah, 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 blah. So, you know, I'm definitely talking about my two favorite outside issues, even though there were more. But I smoked a lot of pot, and it was the 80s in New York City, a lot of cocaine. So, but anyway, drinking was always my true love, and I never did any of the others without drinking. So anyway, I would say by junior year in New York, I was getting really tired, and I had the opportunity to make my first geographic change. And I had minored in French, so I had an opportunity to go over to school in France. So I figured, oh, this will be great. It'll be, you know, I'll go over and I'll start to study and I'll get serious. After all, I've only got 2 more years left. I got to really get my life together. And so I did. I went over to a city called Nantes in France, and I spent a wonderful semester there. However, I didn't clean the slate like I thought I would do. I actually lived with a 19-year-old French student, and that little city of Nantes, we tore up just as bad as I did New York City. And it was really, thank goodness it was pass-fail, because I definitely just passed by the skin of my teeth. And again, it was, you know, it was, it planted so many seeds in me to that would be with me for the rest of my life, as far as, you know, this thrill of adventure, this, you know, these adrenaline rushes, trying new things, et cetera. So anyway, that summer, after my junior semester, I backpacked through Europe, and I remember it was like I had $300 to travel for almost 2 months. So the first stop was Amsterdam to load up, and then the second stop, half of my money went to that, and then the second stop was London to get my hair done. And I don't know if you remember back in the 80s, but it was like hot pink, shaved up one side, and I had these big white shoots coming out the front. And I bought all my clothes in Portobello Road, you know, I mean, and everywhere I went, I was supported by party people, you know? I mean, isn't it weird? It's like we're magnets for party people everywhere I went. And so I had literally, like, no money left, and I still made it for, like, over a month, just, like, sleeping in park benches and hanging out, people buying us stuff. And anyway, it was really, at this point, it was still a lot of fun. Don't you love how when you're, you know, recounting some stories, sometimes people are like, no, Jane, you think you were having fun. But no, I was really having a lot of fun. I had a lot of fun. And so anyway, after that whole experience, and I mean, I think we saw something like 13 countries in that time. I went back to New York and was going to finish off senior year. And I thought, you know, okay, clean slate again. I'm really going to get serious this time. And it just got worse than ever. We all know the story, right? And so I graduated from college. I moved to this city called Hoboken, New Jersey, and I lived right across the river from my beloved city. But I thought maybe that would, you know, be far enough to really get carried away. Wrong. Hoboken was, at that time, it was just you know, mostly young people. It was a real party city, and where all my siblings kind of after college just, you know, sort of conformed to what they were supposed to do in life. After college, I was off to the races. And I lucked out, and that was a theme throughout my whole early life, was I was like bubbly and cute and funny, and I could talk my way out of anything. I was manipulative. I was, you know, I looked innocent, so I got away with so much. And this is like about this, like here's a perfect example. My first job that I got was teaching high school. I taught high school English and French. And I taught for like 2 years, and I don't know where I got the energy to do what I did, really. I mean, you know, I would literally be up partying every night, all night, and by this time I still say it was partying, but I still got up, and it was this crazy work ethic that my dad instilled in us all. Like, no matter what, I got up and went to work in the morning, even if it was just to go home and take a shower and, you know, go to work. And I can't believe that I did that for as long as I did, but I actually did that for like 3 years. After 3 years, man, I was getting tired again. And I had one of the teachers that I was teaching high school with had just had a sabbatical, so he went over to Japan to teach. So I was like, oh man, that's what I got to do. I'm gonna interview for that job. And I remember the guy that was interviewed in like New York, Miami, Chicago, you know, L.A. So I interviewed with this guy and got the job. And 2 weeks later, I was on a plane to Japan. And I remember the guy that was sitting next to me on the plane was like, man, that's pretty ballsy. I mean, you're going to Japan. Do you speak any Japanese? And I was like, I know how to say domo arigato, Mr. Roboto. That's about it. That's really about it. But I heard all these things about Japan, like, you know, there's no drugs over there. If you get caught with something, you go to, you know, joint or something, you go to prison for 7 years, and, you know, and they seem like a reserved bunch of people that really, you know, maybe not too many people with drinking problems. Well, I worked for Time Life Educational Services, and they actually contracted teachers out to some of the large companies like Toyota or Nissan or, you know, any of the big companies. So I actually lived in Nagoya, which was Toyota City. And so I had to go and stay with, it was mostly managers that were being shipped overseas after they took an intensive English course, which was what I was teaching. So I had to pretty much eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner with them, and every night for a month. And every night drink with them. And I'll tell you, that's when the really good cultural exchanges went down. but I mean, that was my life. And I went for a year, and I ended up staying for 3 years. And while I was over there, it was just a bunch of crazy Brits and Australians and New Zealanders. And I mean, it was just a crazy lifestyle that we did for like 3 years. And the Japanese, they're just, you know, turn their heads. They were just like, oh, the crazy gaijin, let them do whatever they're doing, you know. But over here, I would have been arrested so many times with some of the shenanigans that we pulled. But anyway, so I did that for 3 years. And then, you know, by this time, I was pushing like 30. And it was like, well, maybe now it's time for me to, you know, go home. Recently, one of my good friends in London cut a page out of her diary, and it said, "My girlfriend Jane decided to cut back on her drinking, which means she didn't drink for lunch on Thursday." So that was indicative of what was going on with me at that time in my life. That's when, you know, I knew I had a problem. Actually, when I was doing some of those trainings with those guys is when I first started, you know, really shaking in the morning, and I needed to drink to, like, level out. And I really, and of course, I ended up finding outside issues while I was over there, too. I was hanging with a bunch of musicians, and, I mean, really, just always living on the edge. That was my thing. So, anyway, coming back to New York, I was like, you know, oh, and I didn't mention this either. I don't know about you, but there comes a time where you're just like, you say you're never going to cross certain lines, and then slowly but surely, all those lines you start to cross. Well, I started to cross a lot of those lines, you know, like I started, especially like with my morals. And, you know, I mean, many of, if you're an alcoholic, so most of us sitting in this room know exactly what I'm talking about. You know, just making really bad judgment calls. I just always had this thing for like drinking men. Like, you know, it had to be a man that drank, and it was almost like having bad semi-consensual relationships with people. And I started to become incapable of acting in a way that would preserve my dignity. And I just ended up, you know, waking up in hazes, and then what I would do is just drink again to, you know, sort of kill that fog. It sort of, drinking for me diluted that kind of discomfort, and I started to just lose myself. And, you know, I started doing things like dating married men or ending up, I mean, I had this thing for bad boys and, you know, I mean, I started to lose myself, and all of that included with the alcoholism, and that I started to become self-aware that I had an issue. So anyway, I came back. I'm going to really cut my drinking stuff short now, but I remember I got my first DUI pretty immediately when I got back from Japan, and I had a friend of mine down in the Florida Keys that owned a restaurant, and I thought, oh, well, yeah, maybe I'll go down and I'll try and get sober down in the Florida Keys. So that's what I did. The Florida Keys, to make a long story short, ended up being, that place really brought me to my knees, you know? I mean, I went from drinking, like I loved vodka. That was my drink of choice. I went from drinking, like, Stoli and Absolut to, like, Popov out of the bottle. I went from, not eating and just smoking cigarettes and drinking. And, of course, I went, you know, from snorting to smoking cocaine. I mean, it was when I really was brought down to my knees. And I remember there was the proverbial looking in the mirror. I remember I was probably about 110 pounds. And, like, I could just touch something and I would turn black and blue. I was just so malnourished, so tired. And I remember looking in the mirror and not recognizing myself. I always hear that in stories, but I had that. I mean, I was just like, oh, my God. And I remember I called a cousin of mine who was up in Fort Lauderdale, and I got out of there. And by this time, my family had pretty much pulled away from me, especially my parents. They were pretty hardcore, so they didn't like the pain that I was putting them through. And that kind of led me to, like, drink and use at them. I never felt like when they didn't accept me, it was like, fine, you don't accept me, but all these friends of mine, you know, do, and people in the bar do, and, you know, who cares? And it just started, you know, I just started getting into that deeper, darker place. But So I moved to Fort Lauderdale and was pretty much saved by my cousin, and it was there that I met this guy, and I remember he had that same adventuresome spirit that I did, and he was actually starting a travel company, and so this one weekend he wanted to go down to the Florida Keys. So I was like, oh, God, you know, that's going to be tough. But he really partied and liked to have a good time, too. So we proceeded to go down, and at the first tiki bar we hit, we started drinking. And we kept every single tiki bar that we hit on our way down to, you know, Key West, we would go into. And so this went on for most of the night. And I remember that night there was a band playing and at one of the bars that I used to hang out at. So we went there, had a bunch of drinks, and then decided to go back down to the old 7 Mile Bridge. I don't know if anyone's familiar with that, but so anyway, we're driving down, and I remember seeing this sign that said authorized vehicles only. And I was like, oh, well, vehicles, let's go down, you know. And so we drove down. And actually, earlier that evening, we went there to watch the sun go down. So I thought it would be kind of cool to watch the sun come up. So we're driving down that bridge. And all of a sudden, we went around a slight curve. And the next thing I remember is just this thunderous crash and this bolt of lightning. And it went through my very core. And I remember opening my eyes, and we were just accordioned into, like, this cement barrier. And on the other side of the barrier was the water. And later on, I learned that they had just filmed that movie, True Lies, with Arnold Schwarzenegger. And so they blew the bridge up. And so that was the barrier that I went barreling into. And I remember I put my hand down to my ankle, and I felt the bones in my ankle. And I was like, oh, my God. And I pulled my hand up, and it was just dripping with blood. And I was like, oh, my God, how did that happen? Where did that come from? What are we going to do? How are we going to get out of this? And I remember looking over at Max, and he looked like he hit his head, and he was just sleeping. And I started shaking his arm, and I was like, Max, wake up, wake up. How are we going to get out of this? I can't move. Please help me. And there was no response. And it didn't take me too long to figure out that he wasn't breathing anymore and that he was dead. God, I hate this part of the story. Anyway, let me just get through this really fast. So, I remember every breath that I was taking was a conscious effort to breathe because I couldn't, my lung was punctured from my ribs. And there was a part of me that just didn't want to breathe. I just wanted to die too. I was like, how am I going to live with myself? Oh, my God. My family, his family. I'm just a drunk driver, piece of crap that ended up killing somebody. So anyway, I remember it had to be a couple of hours later, and I remember thinking, oh my God, I can't do this anymore. It was almost like right when I said that I saw the blue lights in the background, and it was this police officer that he was just so wonderful and loving, and he just kept saying, keep breathing, we got to get you out of here. And later on, I have to tell you, later on, at one of the hearings, I saw that police officer, and he told me that he literally was going down the regular bridge part of the road, and he backed his car up to go down there, and he never went down there. And then he said that he had a spiritual moment because something pulled him down that road. But if it wasn't for him, I know that I wouldn't be here. So anyway, I got heliported down to University of Miami Hospital, and the next thing I knew, it was a couple days later, and over the bed was I just remember seeing my dad and one of my brothers, and talk about crazy. I remember the first thing that I said to my dad was, it didn't happen because I was drinking, you know? And that look on my dad's face, like, oh my God. So, fast forward, I ended up breaking my neck at C1, C2, which is the same fracture that Christopher Reeve had. So it's really, I'm not joking when I say it's a miracle that I'm standing up here right now. And I hate talking about my physical injuries, but you can imagine the emotional part of it. Oh, man. So what happened next was I was in the hospital for like 6 months, and then I got discharged, awaiting prison, awaiting trial, I should say. Well, I actually pled guilty, and I was sentenced to 5 years in prison, followed by 10 years of probation, and I started going to AA. I remember right before the judge let me out on my own recognizance before prison to undergo physical therapy. And so I went to a 7 a.m. meeting every morning because the only time I was allowed to leave the house was for an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting and physical therapy. And let me tell you, that group, and it was in St. Pete Beach, Florida, that group saved my life. You know, they were saying stuff to me like, "Oh, there but for the grace of God go I," and, "Oh, man, I did some crazy stuff too, man. I used to drive blackouts with my kids in the car, and, you know, that so easily could have been me," and for some reason that stuff made me feel better, you know, like I wasn't such a freak, and the unconditional love that they showed me, it was almost like a mother's love to her child, really helped me get through that. So anyway, I went to prison, and I did the 5 years in Florida. It's eight. You're going to do 85%. So I did 4 years and 3 months, and then I did 10 years of probation. So just very quickly, let me just tell you about prison. And I feel like I needed prison. I feel like I needed to be segregated from society. I feel like if I didn't go away, I might not have made it because I think I might have gone back. But I needed time. I needed to really go on a mining expedition to find out who I was. And I needed that 5 years. I really did. And I deserved it too. And some of the finest women that I met in my life I met in prison. And for all of you who bring the meetings into prison, thank you, because those women, I remember just seeing their smiles and seeing how they acted and loved life. I mean, it meant the world to me. They were like my heroes while I was in there, and they gave me hope and really gave me something to look forward to when I got out. And I also, once again, you know, there's so many stories that I could tell you about pivotal moments of change and transformation while I was in there, but the one that comes to my mind was, I remember it was Easter week, and it was a young priest. I went to confession, and I remember he kind of was looked like Jesus. He looked like the Sacred Heart of Jesus, had a beard, and he was, you know, young, and I was telling him my sins, and sure enough, when I looked up, his chin was shaken, and he had tears in his eyes, and I was like, "Oh, look at the priest is crying," you know? And then I realized, oh, my God. And then he looked at me, and he said, "Jane, if I could, I would take you by the neck right now and throw you up against the wall. When are you going to accept God's forgiveness? Who do you think you are? Do you think you're above God's forgiveness? Every time you go to confession, I hear the same sin over and over again. Every time I tell you your sins are forgiven, it's almost like, you know, we throw your sins out there into the sea of forgiveness, and you keep reeling them back in. Don't even come to confession. Don't come to Mass. Don't do anything anymore with your faith until you come to terms with that." And I was just like, whoa, I couldn't believe it. And I mean, he was mad. But I'll tell you something, that did something to me when I left and I thought about it and I prayed about it and I was like, you know, he's right. And it was at that point where I knew I had to deal with self-forgiveness, but more importantly, I had to deal with redemption, right? I had to just rebuild my life and keep doing the next right thing. And really that made the next few years getting through, you know, a a prison situation where every day is, you know, there are adverse situations, let's face it. But every day is also ripe for learning, you know, and I learned so many things. But anyway, when I got out of prison is when, you know, of course the true tests happen, you know. I kept in touch with my AA sponsor the whole time we were in prison. I actually, another Catholic priest, after Mass one Sunday, said, ladies, I talked to the warden. I want to let you know that I'm an alcoholic in recovery, so if anyone wants to come and do their fifth step with me, you know, I have permission. So I figured, oh, well, confession and fifth step, kill two birds with one stone, I'm in. So I did, and you know, I remember that was another pivotal moment in my life when I felt like so much less of a freak and so much more of a member of the human race after I did my fifth step. So until the pain gets strong enough, I don't think any of us are going to change. And that whole experience did that for me. And, you know, while I prefer to, you know, kind of glance at my past instead of staring at it, I know that I took a lot of valuable things out of that, you know, but I also concentrate on the best moments of those difficult times as opposed to the worst ones. I really try to be careful, as the big book says, not to drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection. Why? Because that would diminish our usefulness to others. So I try to stay positive. Every day I do my daily review. I ask for God's forgiveness and what corrective measures I need to take when I'm wrong. And I am so grateful for this program of Alcoholics Anonymous, for this non-religious path, spiritual growth, self-help, but also mutual assistance. We couldn't do this without each other, you know? And I remember early in sobriety, people used to say, like, every answer you need is in that big book. And thank God I had, you know, wonderful sponsorship throughout the years where they would point that out to me. And I know that as I stumble along my path in life, that the answer is only 12 steps away. I know that. So just very quickly, some of the things that this program has done for me, it's made me realize that every time I go off the path, I know it's when I keep placing my will between me and God. I mean, it's as easy as that. I mean, I know that I start running, whenever I start running the show, that's when trouble's right around the corner, you know? And I know that I constantly have to turn it over. And once again, isn't that one of those counterintuitive wisdoms that I was talking about? Really, in turning it over, that's when I feel true spiritual independence, you know? I know that I have to work with others, and I try to do that not only in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I try to do it to anybody who needs help. I'm also a breast cancer survivor, so I'm a volunteer in you know, it's called Reach for Recovery. I also work with a group of young adults in an organization called To Write Love on Her Arms for college students who are depressed, experiencing substance abuse issues or gender identity issues. So you know, there are plenty of opportunities to be of service out there, but as we know, most importantly, it's to help one alcoholic helping another alcoholic. What this program helps me to do on a daily basis is to drop my ego and to transcend into a place of humility and admit my wrongs and to be incredibly honest. Always, honesty is at the forefront. Sometimes I'm really good at self-deception. So, you know, the accountability that this program offers with other people, you know, mutually assisting us through our difficulties is what gets me through. I know that we're supposed to talk about what it's like now, so I want to do that very quickly. When I got out of prison, I remember I had a really difficult time finding a job. And, you know, because being an ex-offender, it's tough. So the first job I got was being a housekeeper in a hotel, and I very quickly got promoted to the front desk. And I remember I was making $7 an hour. And let me tell you, that was the best job I ever had, you know? And because really, when you get out of prison, you are kind of like weird, you know? And it kind of was a great job to help me ease back into, you know, being around people again. And so, and then I decided, well, I ended up getting sent to a work release program in Tallahassee, Florida. And so I thought, well, Florida State University's here. Maybe I can, you know, go back to school. But first I tried getting a teaching job, and they said, there's no way you're ever going to teach again. You know, hang that up. And so I said, okay, well, what can I do to dedicate the rest of my life to love and service? And so being a social worker came to my mind. So I decided to apply to Florida State University, and I remember I wrote like not once, not twice, three letters, and finally that third time I got accepted. I got denied the first two times because of my felony record. And all the while, too, I need to mention, I lost my license for life. Like, I have, you know, I'll never drive again. I won't even ever be eligible for a hardship license. But that's okay. I ride my bike everywhere. I keep in shape. And, you know, and it everything's cool with that. I ended up, the 10 years of probation, I had to go to an AA meeting every day. That's what my judge said. Every day. Can you imagine? Even my probation officer was like, oh, my God, I never heard that before. But So I ended up getting an apartment very close to the AA house in Tallahassee, and for the first 5 years, I went to a meeting every day, in addition to trying to rebuild my life. And in the last 5 years, I went before the judge, and I said, you know, can I please get this relaxed a little bit, because, you know, I mean, it's kind of tough. And she said, okay, five times a week. So I really did that, and I thank God for it now, even though when I was going through it, it was, you know, really difficult. But not having a car, trying to rebuild your life, sometimes it just seemed like it was insurmountable. Asking people to give you a chance is really humbling, you know? But I remember I would just look in people's eyes and just say, please, where would any of us be without a second chance? Please give me an opportunity to prove myself. And believe it or not, so many people wanted to do that. I remember, too, one of the things that I deal with the most out of character defects, that is, are resentments. And I have to really work on that daily. One of my other favorite nuns, I don't know if any of you have ever heard of Sister B, but she gave me this prayer, so it's called Prayer for Resentments, and I thought I would just share that with you right now. God, help me to look with soft eyes upon all who are part of my days. Break through the barriers of my scrutinizing views. Transform my inner landscape into a peaceful place of acceptance. Pull back my projections and my criticisms. Replace my mean measurements and my biased expectations with an openness that allows others just to be. Cleanse me of everything that clouds my perceptions and blocks the sunlight of your spirit. You know, I can't help but to be incredibly thankful for the second chances that I've had. You know, the opportunity to do things that I never thought I would have a chance to do again. I graduated from Florida State University with my master's degree. My first job was working at a detox and in a psychiatric unit with people who were in crisis. And then after doing that for 5 years, I worked my way up to being the supervisor. And then I got these really, and I'm saying this for the newcomers because it's unbelievable thinking that, like, really, at this point in my life, it was just like maybe 8 years before where I was sitting on a prison bunk. And then all of a sudden, I won from the National Association of Social Workers, Social Worker of the Year. I got asked by Florida State University to be an adjunct professor, and I started teaching chemical dependency. And it was after a couple of years of doing that, I got a phone call from the dean at the College of Social Work and asked if I would be interested in a full-time faculty position. So currently, I am an assistant professor at Florida State University. Thank you. Thank you. I mean, truly, that's a miracle when you think of it, you know. It's never too late to be the person that God really meant for you to be. I believe that with all my heart. And I think that my life now is just, it's never been better. I've never been happier. In case you're wondering, my relationship with my family has been completely mended. I can honestly say that my parents are proud of me. And at the age of 52, I met the love of my life. You know, I've never been married. I've never even lived with a guy. And boom, James walks into my life. And we just had the best summer of our lives. We went to Spain and Portugal, and he put a ring on it. And yay! And it's just crazy. I mean, I never thought that I would that this would be my life. And I know beyond the shadow of a doubt that anything that's put before me, God and I can handle together. And thank goodness I have this program to guide me through life and to offer me all these beautiful gifts. I love this saying, so I just want to close with this. You know, I'm far from perfect, but I really do strive to live my life by growing as a result of becoming aware of my imperfections. But a new life has definitely been given to me. If we follow these principles, these are the things that happen. We find hope instead of desperation, faith instead of despair, courage instead of fear, peace of mind instead of confusion, self-respect instead of self-contempt, self-confidence instead of helplessness. We gain the respect of others instead of their pity and contempt. We have a clean conscience, that's my favorite, instead of guilt. We have real friendships instead of loneliness. I want to close with my favorite prayer, besides the third step, the 12-step prayer. And I want to thank you all once again for just a wonderful few days together. Dear God, my spiritual awakening continues to unfold. The help I have received, I shall pass on and give to others, both in and out of the fellowship. For this opportunity, I am grateful. I pray most humbly to continue walking day by day on the road of spiritual progress. I pray for the inner strength and wisdom to practice the principles of this way of life in all I say and in all I do. I need you, my friends, and the program every hour of every day. This is a better way to live. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.